William Berg loves history, and Sacramento's history is his passion. A prolific author and regular speaker on some of the capital city's most entertaining yet least known stories, William joins us today to have a conversation on Sacramento's past and its best kept secrets. William, what is the importance of us knowing our history?
One of the main draws of history is the inspiration that you can get from it. But not everybody is always inspired by history. We learn history for the stereotypic is to avoid making the mistakes of the past and to inform future decisions. But very often, a lot of people look at the icons that we hold up as examples of great civic leaders of the past, and they don't see someone who looks like them or thinks like them. And for others, they may see someone who looks like them and thinks like them, but they don't see icons held up in people of the past that don't look like them or don't think like them. And in both cases, it disconnects us from our past. And so it becomes harder to learn, harder to make that connections to the history of our communities, the history of people who don't look like us, and the values of our society almost get lost, because the lessons that were learned through hard experience, through blood, through labor, they don't get passed along without that sense of history, whether it's a physical place like a historic building or the story of a person from our past. When a building's demolished, it's gone. It's easy to forget. If a person is no longer there and their story isn't told, then their story can vanish. So that's the risk we have with not learning our history. And that's the kind of history that I try to focus on, is the untold stories.
When you're sharing Sacramento's history with others, what inspires you from their reactions when they learn about things that might be kind of surprising to them?
That's really the part of it, is the challenge of the unknown. If you're a gold miner, you want to mine gold where no one else has mined it, because you're more likely to find it there. It may not be there, but at least no one else has looked and gone there before you. So it's the opportunity to map out new roads. And then very often making connections with people who don't think of history as something interesting or something engaging. People talk about history the way they talk about broccoli. They know it's good for you, but they haven't had any lately. But how do you make broccoli interesting? Little cheese sauce, a little bacon makes it tasty. So making history tasty, making something that tastes good, that people enjoy, and they want to share it, that's really fun.
What story dealing with the history of Sacramento tends to be the most tasty to the audiences that you speak to?
Well, the new flavor that I've kind of become obsessed with over the past decade or so are the stories of the West End. And that's the neighborhood that Sacramento doesn't have anymore, roughly from about 9th Street on Capitol Avenue to the river. That part of the city where there's nothing older than about 1950, where we used to have a neighborhood of extraordinary diversity and vitality. It was the heart of Sacramento's African-American neighborhood. It's Japantown. The Latino community was centered there. The southern end of our Chinatown and other communities of color, all in one place, along with a built environment that a lot of it dated back to the gold rush.
And in that West End neighborhood, what aspect of it would people be most surprised to learn about that it was known for during the time that it was thriving?
Well, it was known for a lot of things, for the political activism and community spirit of those communities of color, of the businesses that they engendered, including things like restaurants, live entertainment, music, art, and other community institutions that they built, often with a lot of community resistance from the rest of the city.
And all of that was wiped away because of what?
Because of redevelopments in the 1950s, federal funds became available to remove large portions of American cities. Sacramento became, in a lot of cases, a test market for some new mechanisms to finance redevelopment. One was called tax increment financing. It's it became known as the Sacramento model. And because Sacramento was a city of relatively moderate size, unlike really large cities, we were able to demolish that neighborhood so completely that in a lot of ways it was erased from our cultural memory.
Wow. So tell us about some of the leading institutions that were within this neighborhood and what they provided that really speaks to how lively and vibrant it was.
Well, in the case of Sacramento's African American community, which dates back to the Gold Rush, there were churches like St. Andrew's AME.
And that one is still around.
Right? Yeah, that are still around. Or Siloam Baptist Church, which is still around, Shiloh Baptist Church. And they fought for the right of African Americans to be able to testify in court, which wasn't allowed in the 1850s. This was before the end of slavery in the United States. And there was the white people of California essentially were divided into two camps. One that felt that California should be a slave state, and one that felt that it should be whites only. That put the communities of color of California in a pretty uncomfortable position, but they decided rather than to give in, but to fight. And so that political legacy was really the foundation of Sacramento. And then 50 years later, the term the West End came from a group called the West End Club, which was known by a few different names. Was the Eureka Club and a few other names for an organization was intended as an African-American parallel to the Sutter Club, as a community organization.
Really?
for political organizing, for social advancement, and also for recreation and for business. And that's what, so far as I know, is the institution that gave the neighborhood its name. Prior to that, it was called the Tenderloin, or the Japanese American community, which also grew up more in the late 19th century as immigrants started coming in from Japan. Sacramento, about 1910, 1920, it wasn't the largest Japantown in the United States, but in terms of percentages of population, we were one of the most Japanese cities in the United States. And so they brought their civic institutions, churches and social organizations, and their cultural institutions, sushi and sake, and these were all present in Sacramento during this era, mixed with what was available in the United States to create something new, a Japanese American community.
What part of Sacramento's founding and its early days has by and large been forgotten by all of us that have lived here and enjoy the city as it is today?
Sometimes it wasn't necessarily forgotten by those of us who have lived here, but we never learned it in the first place. And so that the history of our Chinatown, another legacy of the Gold Rush, and their very often their alliances with the African-American community for that right of testimony and to overcome other social barriers. They were different neighborhoods, physically parallel to each other, located in the same neighborhood, but often living separate lives. But they all were part of this greater whole of the West End, which if from today's perspective, we'd look at this neighborhood and we'd see a walkable, dense, mixed-use neighborhood with good transit access and accessibility to thousands and thousands of jobs, and a wonderfully culturally diverse neighborhood with many entertainment options. But in the early 20th century, they called it blight.
What's interesting is that if this was such a vibrant neighborhood and arts and culture and entertainment were all available there, all of that was destroyed by redevelopment. And we've invested hundreds of millions of dollars, essentially in things like the Golden One Center, the improvements to our museums and things like that, to bring all that back. And so it's almost like a cycle that has repeated itself.
There's a saying that history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. But there are common themes. There were efforts to try to clean up the West End as early as the early 1900s because it was already a fairly notorious neighborhood. And a lot of it had its origins, quite frankly, in racism. And in Sacramento, trying to reclaim its civic identity. We had been the second largest city on the West Coast, and we saw other cities supersede Sacramento for that position. We fell farther and farther behind.
Wait a minute. I have to jump in. Sacramento was the second largest city on the West Coast?
From really the beginnings of our days as a state up until the mid-1870s, around 1880, that's when Los Angeles, because they had a land boom and two transcontinental railroads in a rate war with each other, they superseded us. And then that same railroad came to Oakland, and Oakland got bigger than us. And then Portland and Seattle grew bigger than us, and we felt ourselves shrinking. And Sacramento civic leaders said, well, what's the problem here, and how do we solve it?
Well, you know, that's interesting, because the big four all used to live here, Huntington, Crocker, Stanford, and I'm forgetting the last one.
Mark Hopkins.
They all at one point had resided in Sacramento, and then they migrated away to other places. What happened to Sacramento being such a major, at least for that era, metropolis? And did we kind of lose our mojo?
Not so much the mojo. The number one was the gravity of San Francisco. That's where the big four moved. That was traditionally the pattern. You moved to Sacramento, made your money, and then moved to San Francisco, and you built your great civic edifices there. And maybe your house in Sacramento became an orphanage or something. And so, except for E.B. Crocker, who founded the Crocker Museum. So we didn't necessarily lose our mojo, as we just got bounced out of line. Part of it was weather, flooding, access to a port, or to having multiple railroads. It just kind of worked out that way. But the solution Sacramento's leaders came up with was, instead they would deny that we were a city. And the mythology of Sacramento as a quiet bucolic farm town, which we never were, began to supplant the image of Sacramento as bustling city. And that's when, in some cases, the deification of John Sutter as the original farmer who benevolently came to Sacramento and taught the Nissanon how to farm. But I hope you don't. Yeah, I'm being very sarcastic here, but
it's okay. But you said something that really jumped out at me, which is that Sacramento was never a farm town. We label ourselves today as the farm to fork capital of the world. I'm trying to figure out the basis on how you make that statement and how you connect that up to all of our trumpeting about our farm to fork history.
We've got plenty of forks, but not a lot of farms. Every city is surrounded by farms, and every city was surrounded by farms and other resources areas. In fact, it's a major theme in urban history, is connecting resource flows from great cities like Chicago to the primate city. And this is where that food gets turned into something that you can ship. And we also built the systems that you shipped those goods on. We built the first transcontinental railroad principally to ship the product of the valley, but it wouldn't have been shippable if you couldn't bring it to Sacramento, which had that large, diverse population. We built railroads, we built railroad locomotives, and we canned and bottled and brewed and stored and froze all of the goods of the valley to turn them into something else. That transformation is a power that cities have that we still have. But in a lot of cases, because we have this civic mental image of the bucolic farm town still, we focus on the farm to fork instead of the forks themselves, instead of the people who are working the farms, instead of the people who are transforming.
So you consider the whole farm to fork kind of mantra a bit of a mythology?
It's definitely mythology. And myths can be useful. Myths can be helpful. And what I'm trying to do is essentially introduce other myths. And myths, whether they're true or not, are less important than what's the lesson that they deliver. Do they educate? And is that education real? And the farm myth has its hazards, and it has its aspects regarding race that have been really poisonous in some ways to our city. And again, because we're in a 21st century city where things like having a diverse population, having a lively and active downtown are desirable, they were very much not half a century ago. They were very much not during the redevelopment era. The word city was a four-letter word.
Well, it did seem like for many years up until recently, we kind of liked being quote-unquote sleepy Sacramento. But in one of your books, Dirty Sacramento, You talk about that Sacramento actually at one point had a pretty racy past.
Wicked Sacramento is the title. Sacramento. Yeah, I also give these talks called Dirty History Talks, but Wicked Sacramento, it was part of a series called Wicked. I wanted to call it something else, but they said, well, why don't you talk about this? And well, the West End was accused of wickedness. It was essentially Sacramento's zone of legalized sex work, in the same way as the Stingery in San Diego, or the Levee in Chicago, or Storyville in New Orleans. And typically, those zones of legalized sex work were also located next to the neighborhoods of African Americans and Chinese. They're considered the least desirable spots in the city by the power that were. So they all got associated with each other. They were associated with alcohol and with other sorts of carrying on, dancing, and great music. This was the birth of jazz happened in the early 20th century. And I mentioned the West End Club. They were the group that brought jazz as a brand new African-American art form to this city. And it was so exciting, so compelling, that white kids started going to black dances. And that caused a huge outcry among the powers that were in Sacramento. And so that was part of the motivation for redevelopment, is eliminating a risk to white supremacy via cultural beauty.
It's interesting when you talk about this intersection between the growth of Sacramento and some of the things that made Sacramento unique, and issues of race and power and neighborhoods. How do you react to the notion that sometimes is talked about that there are actually three Sacramentos, the part that makes up the local politics and are really kind of government driven, and the surrounding business community, the world of the state capital and state politics, which is kind of like a solar system to itself. But then there's a third one that's talked about, which is a rarely seen and hardly ever spoken of group of families that are woven together through property ownership, you know, family alliances, social relationships, that have been here almost since the beginning and still exert a great deal of influence behind the scenes on what happens here.
There are definitely those three Sacramentos and those three loci of power, in part because we voluntarily gave up our industrial base. Part of it was a deliberate effort by the city to not be a place that's known for canneries and railroads, but instead for government agencies and military installations, because those were considered white-collar jobs held by white people, whereas a lot of these industrial jobs were held by people of color and were blue-collar and union jobs. That third institution you mentioned, Sacramento's long-standing families, we do have our own, the people who didn't move to San Francisco, and they still have a large measure of power, but partially they're defined by their modesty. They don't want to feel like they're these paragons of wealth. And so they didn't build mansions in public view the way that the Stanfords and Crockers did. They built them farther away. And the state, it definitely has its own nexus of power. People talk about Sacramento when they talk about California politics, the same way they talk about Hollywood when they're talking about entertainment, or they talk about Silicon Valley when they're talking about tech. So that's our association, and it does have value and it does have power. But a lot of people feel very removed from it. Typically, when they say the word Sacramento regarding state politics, it's usually not a compliment.
You know, when you talk about the families and the power and how things were organized decades ago, one name that comes up sometimes is Bartley Kavanaugh, the storage city manager, who wasn't even, you know, a business leader in town, but the city manager of Sacramento, he has a golf course named after him, who really was like the Robert Moses, the guy who redefined New York. But Kavanaugh did that for Sacramento. Who was this guy, and what was his contribution to the Sacramento we know today?
Okay. To be honest, I only know a little bit about Bart Kavanaugh, but he's a very, very major figure in Sacramento's history. And it has to do with the way that our city government worked. From the 1890s to sort of the beginning of that Sutter era that I talked about until 1911, we had what was called a strong mayor system. And in 1911, we did away with that with a short-lived system that's called a commission system. And in 1921, we established the mayor council, the council manager system, which was modeled after corporate structures. You have a professional CEO that is responsible to the board of directors, the city council. And so the city manager, if it was someone who was a skilled manager, could have enormous power. And because of the connections to the state and to the wealthy regional folks that you mentioned, that third group, you could really do a lot. And Kavanaugh was very skilled at making connections with those organizations. That's another Sacramento characteristic. The way I say it is, we're not a small town, but we're a very networked one. You can networking.
Well, when you talk about the networking, there's a story you tell about Kavanaugh and a conversation he had that people are still trying to find out the truth of. Can you share that with us?
This is unverified, but supposedly the appointment of Earl Warren to the Supreme Court was the result of a golf game between Bartley Kavanaugh and then General Dwight D. Eisenhower, but I don't know whether or not it's true.
That is so interesting. When we talk about these neighborhoods and their destruction through redevelopment and then rejuvenation today and all that, Sacramento has a history of destroying its heritage. And the case example I use is the destruction of the Alhambra, which now is a Safeway, and all that's left is a remnant of a fountain on the property. Is there a lack of care related to maintaining that heritage and history that's unique to Sacramento?
I'd say absolutely not. The demolition of the Alhambra happens for a lot of reasons, but the fight to save it was enormous. A lot of the people involved in trying to save the Alhambra, which became a huge effort, was a diverse mixture of everything from a dentist who was on the county board of supervisors to young hippies who wanted to use the Alhambra Theater as a rock and roll palace. So that drew a community of Sacramento's preservationists together, in this similar to the way that they'd done for Old Sacramento a decade before, but it became a much more broad and widespread constituency. And the same way that Penn Station in New York City became this symbol of what is at risk if we lose our historic resources, remember the Alhambra is still remembered today, half a century later, by people who weren't born when it was demolished. And only a couple years after that, that's when the city of Sacramento got its first preservation ordinance. And as a result, we have 32 local historic districts with more coming. We have hundreds of individual landmarks, and we have very robust historic preservation advocacy, both in the community and a not bad program run by the city. So there are certainly people who don't see value in these. Very often there are people maybe who just haven't been to downtown Sacramento since 1970, and they, for all they know, it still looks like the way they remember it. But in that half a century, we really have started to gain a sense of self and a sense of the importance of our community through the legacy of the built environment. And that diversity is another part of it, not just the history of working people in communities of color, but the built environment, the places that they lived and the buildings that they built and the associations with them.
When you talk about the built environment and redevelopment and the destruction of the West End, where did those people go?
That was a question I asked after I wrote about redevelopment. And the answer was in a book I wrote called Sacramento Renaissance. And because they were communities of color, they could not move to the suburbs, because when this happened in the 50s and 60s, racial exclusion covenants were still enforced. If you weren't white, you couldn't buy property in most neighborhoods. So the African-American community moved to North Sacramento and Oak Park, the Latino community mostly up into Alkali Flat and further into Southside Park. And then the Japanese and Chinese communities also moved principally into Southside.
One interesting fact you talk about is that if you weren't white, you couldn't move those neighborhoods. Who was not considered white that might be surprising to people today?
That's a changing thing, and it's kind of a moving target. Becoming white is something that happens to a lot of immigrant groups, The ones that I've studied the most are Italians and Portuguese in Southside Park, which for the most part were considered European, but not white when they arrived in the late 19th and early 20th century. But over the course of the 20th century, especially after the Second World War, a lot of these groups were now considered white. And so part of why space was available in Southside Park, an unrestricted neighborhood, was because a lot of the Italians were now moving to East Sacramento following St. Mary's Church, or the Portuguese who were now moving into Land Park in the Pocket. So that created space for the communities that were being forced out of the West End to move into and rebuild.
Fascinating. Well, we're going to leave it there. William, thank you so much for describing a history that many of us have never even heard of before.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks to our guests, and thanks to you for watching Studio Sacramento. I'm Scott Syphax. See you next time right here on KVIE.
Thank you for listening to Studio Sacramento from KVIE Public Television. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes to help others find it.
All episodes of Studio Sacramento, along with other KVIE programs, are available to watch online at kvie.org/video.